And he had been for 8 years a professor at Harvard Law School. And of course, back in college, he'd started the first computerized dating service. So since being on the bench, and he's still doing teaching as an adjunct at NYU, George Mason in Chicago, where he received his law degree from. He clerked for Judge McGowan and for Justice Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court. But that's only part of the story. Judge Ginsburg not only has a truly distinguished career as a judge, but he's also brought his knowledge across the globe, most recently discussing antitrust in Singapore and China. He's participated recently in Federal Society programs in Europe, but while sharing his knowledge of both law and economics across the globe and with students in the United States, he's at the same time secured his reputation as one of the foremost jurists of his time with his work on the DC Circuit. And his work ranges well beyond antitrust, as you will hear shortly. I would add that part of the explanation of his enormous productivity is his intellectual curiosity and interest in a very broad array of topics. He's always fascinating to discuss almost any new development with. At the same time, consistent with this lecture series, he's deeply committed to the rule of law. I am honored to introduce, to deliver the Bob Rolson Lecture, the Honorable Douglas Ginsburg.
Thank you, Gene. Well, it's a privilege to be here, and a special privilege for those of us, I think all of the lecturers so far, who knew Barbara Olson, and who admired her intelligence, her vitality, energy, optimism. And for us, she will be forever young. Well, I woke up on the wrong side of the bed today. The coffee maker failed, so I just wanted to hold something unconstitutional. But the cases didn't lend themselves to that today, so instead I'm going to talk to you about the unitary executive and the non-delegation doctrine. And the remarks I'm going to make are based on an article that's yet to will be out in some months, actually in a month or so, that was co-authored by Steve Menasche, who was chosen by the Federalist Society for the Olin Searle Fellowship, which he's taken to Georgetown Law Center this year. You'll be hearing a lot more from and about Steve in the coming years as he begins his academic career. Now, Americans have always mistrusted executive power, but only recently has the unitary executive emerged as the boogeyman of American politics. According to popular accounts, the idea of the unitary executive is one of presidential dictatorship that will destroy the balance of power shared by our three co-equal branches of government. These are all quotations from the popular press. Readers are led to conclude that the very notion of the unitary executive is a demonic modern invention of political conservatives, a marginal constitutional theory probably invented by Professor John Yoo at UC Berkeley, or a bald-faced power grab conjured up by the administration of George W. Bush, including, most ominously, Vice President Cheney. It's no surprise that the New York Times agreed with then-candidate Joe Biden's assessment that, quote, Mr. Cheney's theory of the unitary executive made him the most dangerous vice president we've had in American history, close quote. Now, in fact, the theory of the unitary executive has nothing to do with the extent of presidential power, but only with who is to exercise those powers, however broad, that are allocated by our Constitution to the executive. Its proponents seek not to evade the limitations of separated power, but rather insist, especially when dealing with the other branches, that the president alone is responsible for the actions of the executive branch. The idea seems ominous today, only because so many functions that have been allocated to the now fragmented executive, that reuniting them under presidential leadership seems both to enhance presidential authority unimaginably and to create unmanageable administrative structures. No one in this room will be surprised to hear that Dick Cheney did not originate the idea that the executive power should be united under presidential control, or maybe vice presidential control. That was part of the original constitutional design. That, in fact, providing for a unitary executive responded to the fear, seldom heard today, I'm afraid, that the Congress would become tyrannical. In Federalist number 51, Madison wrote, "In Republican government, the legislative authority necessarily predominates." Close quote. Now, his remedy for this tendency toward domination was to divide the legislative into three chambers, into different chambers, while the executive was to remain unitary so it would not be overmatched in its battles with the legislature. He explained, as the weight of the legislative authority requires that it should be thus divided, the two chambers, the weakness of the executive may require that it should be fortified. Today, Madison's warning seems quaint. Having seen the socially transformative power of the courts, many understandably scoff at Hamilton's characterization of the judiciary as the least dangerous branch. Editorialists, not surprisingly, conclude that the executive is the most powerful branch and the legislative weak by comparison. And against this newly received wisdom, I suggest that Madison was right and the modern inversion is mistaken. The unitary executive has fallen into ill repute and apparent obsolescence, not because of an executive bent upon autocracy, but because of a legislature freed from the constraints of the separation of powers. I start with the simple reminder that the framers of our Constitution did not establish a parliamentary system. The president is not selected by the Congress. The founders sought to establish a president who was more than an agent of the legislature, as was the prime minister under the historic British Constitution. Quoting Federalist 51 again, "In order to lay a due foundation for that separate and distinct exercise of the different powers of government, it is evident that each department should have a will of its own, and consequently should be so constituted that the members of each should have as little agency as possible in the appointment of the members of the others." The theory of the unitary executive focuses upon the extent to which Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1 of the Constitution, "The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America," protects the president's authority to appoint, direct, and remove officers within the executive branch. Complementing this positive grant of authority is the understanding that the other branches would be confined to their own spheres. And a necessary corollary of the unitary executive finds expression in the non-delegation doctrine. The idea that the Congress cannot delegate its lawmaking powers to the executive or the judiciary. The demise of that doctrine has allowed the Congress both to augment and to fragment the executive by establishing agencies within the executive tasked with making policy pursuant to broad mandates from the Congress, agencies that effectively exercise legislative power through rulemaking. The non-delegation doctrine was once recognized as a foundational principle of the separation of powers. Its roots go back to John Locke, who wrote, "The power of the legislative being only to make laws and not to make legislators, the legislative can have no power to transfer their authority of making laws and place it in other hands." Locke developed the non-delegation doctrine out of an elementary maxim of the law of agency, "Delegata potestas non potest delegari," delegated powers cannot be further delegated. Once the people had delegated the lawmaking power to the legislature, it could pass no farther, lest it elude the people's oversight. Chief Justice Taft recognized the non-delegation doctrine as a fixture of American constitutional law. In J.W. Hampton, the Supreme Court considered whether the Congress may delegate to the president the authority to alter duties imposed by the Tariff Act of 1922. American courts, especially state courts, had been grappling with the reach of the non-delegation doctrine since the beginning of the Republic. Chief Justice Taft drew upon their work, and the cases he cites demonstrate how well understood was the importance of the non-delegation doctrine to the American constitutional system. I'm going to invoke just a couple of the cases. There are many, I assure you. In 1852, the Supreme Court of Ohio had considered whether the state legislature could require county commissioners, upon a referendum of the public, to subscribe to the capital stock of a private company established to build a new railroad and issue bonds in payment. The court started from first principles. That the General Assembly cannot surrender any portion of the legislative authority with which it is invested, or otherwise it's exercised by any other person, or authorized, pardon me, it's exercised by any other person or body, is a proposition too clear for argument and is denied by no one. This inability arises no less from the general principle applicable to every delegated power requiring knowledge, discretion, and rectitude in its exercise than from the positive provisions of the Constitution itself. 1888, the Minnesota Supreme Court considered whether the state legislature could delegate to a commission the authority to set rates for common carriers that are, quote, equal and reasonable, close quote. The court explained the common understanding of the time as follows. The legislative department, to whose judgment and wisdom the high prerogative of making laws has been entrusted, cannot relieve itself of the responsibility by choosing other agencies and substituting their judgment and wisdom for its own. Despite their paean to the non-delegation principle, however, both the Ohio and the Minnesota Supreme Courts and several others upheld the challenged delegation of authority. In J.W. Hampton, the Supreme Court followed suit, first extolling the non-delegation doctrine and then upholding the challenged delegation. Quoting the Ohio Supreme Court, Chief Justice Taft explained, "The true distinction," he said, "is between the delegation of power to make the law, which necessarily involves a discretion as to what it shall be, and conferring an authority or discretion as to its execution, to be exercised under and pursuant and in pursuance of the law." Then to operationalize that distinction, Taft declared the Congress may authorize executive agents to carry out its legislation as long as the Congress, quote, lays down by legislative act an intelligible principle in which the person or body authorized is directed to conform. Despite Taft's careful line drawing, the Supreme Court has invoked this principle of non-delegation to strike down an act of Congress exactly two times. Both in the same year, both with respect to the same act, the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933. Section 9C of the NIRA authorized the president to prohibit the transportation in interstate commerce of petroleum products produced in excess of the amounts permitted by state authority, but did not define the circumstances under which the transportation was to be prohibited. The president was left to adopt his own, quote, code of fair competition for the petroleum industry, close quote, to guide his decisions. And in Panama Refining, the court adjudged Section 9C an unconstitutional delegation of legislative power. So here's what they said. The Congress has declared no policy, has established no standard, has laid down no rule. There is no requirement, no definition of circumstances and conditions in which the transportation is to be allowed or prohibited. This section gives the president an unlimited authority to determine the policy and to lay down the prohibition as he may see fit. Later that same year, the court considered the Code of Fair Competition for the Live Poultry Industry, which, pursuant to the NIRA, had been proposed by the industry and adopted by the president in an executive order. And most of you are familiar with this case, Schechter Poultry, in which the court unanimously held such a delegation of legislative power is unknown to our law and is utterly inconsistent with the constitutional prerogatives and duties of Congress. Justice Cardozo, who had dissented in Panama Refining, now famously declared, "This is delegation running riot. No such plenitude of power is susceptible of transfer." These decisions had momentous political consequences. The NRA, the National Recovery Administration, halted operations. The Congress stopped working on New Deal legislation and looked to the White House for a response to the court. President Roosevelt did respond angrily, denouncing the court for crippling the federal government and imperiling the nation. "We have got to decide," he said, "whether in some way we are going to restore to the federal government the powers which exist in the national government of every other nation in the world." And a debate emerged in the public press about judicial review and the role of the court. And academics deliberated over whether the court's rule against delegation threatened to defeat the efforts of our political democracy to use government as an instrumentality for the effective control of our national economy. Ongoing confrontation with the political branches appeared too perilous a course for the court. And though it's never overruled Schechter or expressly repudiated the intelligible principle standard of J.W. Hampton, its standards for intelligibility have become so flaccid that the Congress may now delegate authority to regulate the private sector, quote, in the public interest, convenience, or necessity, or even to be generally fair and equitable. My colleague Steve Williams and I played a modest role in the last gasps of the non-delegation doctrine in the American trucking case, where our court considered the provision of the Clean Air Act that requires the EPA to set a national ambient air quality standard for pollutants at a level, quote, requisite to protect the public health with an adequate margin of safety, close quote. And because ozone and particulate matter are non-threshold pollutants, the EPA lacked a determinate criterion for setting any particular limit. We held there was no intelligible principle in the act to govern its decisions and remanded the matter to the agency so it might, if possible, construe the act to provide an intelligible principle by which to govern its own decisions. But on further review, the Supreme Court concluded no such construction was necessary because the phrase requisite to the public health was determinate enough in view of the precedents upholding regulation in the public interest. As the court explained, we have almost never felt qualified to second-guess Congress regarding the permissible degree of policy judgment that can be left to those executing or applying the law. True, of course, but why? If non-delegation was so fundamental to our constitutional order, why did it have so little a constraining effect? Why are there only two cases from some 75 years ago in which the court has found an unconstitutional delegation of legislative power? I submit that the explanation lies in Madison's warning about the predominance of the legislature in Republican governments, or what we might today call the counter-majoritarian difficulty. If we look back to the non-delegation cases on which Chief Justice Taft had relied, we see that the judges' rhetorical enthusiasm for the non-delegation doctrine was overmatched by their reluctance to confront the legislature. In the Ohio case, for example, before the court reached the non-delegation issue, it devoted a third of its opinion to justifying its authority to review an act of the legislature for constitutionality, and this 50 years after Marbury versus Madison. After noting that the legislature is of necessity in the first instance to be the judge of its own constitutional powers, the court explained, if a court were to annul the law while entertaining doubts upon the subject, it would present the absurdity of one department of the government overturning in doubt what another has established in settled conviction, and to make the dubious constructions of the judiciary outweigh the fixed conclusions of the legislature. Supreme Court of Massachusetts expressed itself in almost the same terms, announcing its determination, quote, never to declare a statute void unless the nullity and invalidity of the act are placed in their judgment beyond reasonable doubt. Other state courts were of the same diffident view. The Supreme Court of the United States early on expressed a similar hesitancy about declaring an act unconstitutional. Justice Chase had explained in 1796, if the court have such power, I am free to declare that I will never exercise it but in a very clear case. And indeed, it was none other than Chief Justice Marshall, the author of Marbury and the godfather of judicial review, who canonized this deference to the legislature when in 1810 he wrote that before holding a statute unconstitutional, quote, the opposition between the Constitution and the law should be such that the judge feels a clear and strong conviction of their incompatibility with each other. And then in McCulloch versus Maryland, let the end be legitimate and all means that are appropriate, which are plainly adapted to that end, which are not prohibited but consist with the letter and spirit of the Constitution, are constitutional. That was Marshall's reading of the Necessary and Proper Clause, but consider the violence it does to the text. Necessary and proper is the language of strict scrutiny. The Congress may pass laws that are necessary to secure a proper governmental interest. Whatever is not necessary is not authorized. Marshall, however, transformed the clause into a species of rational basis review. The Congress may pass laws that are adapted, which is to say rationally related, to any legitimate government interest. And so the constitutional presumption of liberty, as Randy Barnett of Georgetown calls it, was reversed. Instead of adhering to the constitutional design of limited and enumerated powers, the view that what the Constitution does not authorize the national government to do, it prohibits the national government from doing, the courts decided, rather than confront the legislature, that the national government may do whatever the Constitution does not prohibit. And who can blame them? It would take some nerve for a judge armed only with the power to persuade to tell the people that a law duly adopted by the legislature and signed by the executive will not be enforced because it is not, in the judge's opinion, necessary, but merely expedient. And so the counter-majoritarian difficulty doomed the necessary and proper clause, and along with it, the non-delegation doctrine, long before the court said the last rites. Justice Scalia explained this outcome in his dissent from Mistretta, in which the court had upheld the constitutionality of the Sentencing Commission over a challenge based on separation of powers. He explained that although the non-delegation doctrine is, quote, unquestionably a fundamental element of our constitutional system, sounds familiar, because no statute can be entirely precise and some judgments must be left in the officers executing the law and to the judges applying it, the debate over unconstitutional delegation becomes a debate not over a point of principle, but over a question of degree, close quote. Such a determination involves, as he said, multifarious and in the nonpartisan sense, highly political considerations as to which the Congress and not the court has the institutional competence. Among those considerations, Justice Scalia included whether the nation is at war or faces some inchoate emergency. Now, claims of emergency are indeed matters about which the court is properly hesitant to second guess the political branches. But Justice Scalia's explanation is not convincing. The separation of powers is not a highly political consideration wisely left to the political branches. It's a fundament of the constitutional framework within which the political branches are supposed to operate. No meaningful concept, even of necessity, much less of emergency, could justify routine delegation of the lawmaking function to agencies and courts. What is needed, or what was needed, if it's too late to rescue the non-delegation doctrine, is a Supreme Court that both heeds Madison's warning about the propensity of the legislative power to dominate the other branches, and in response develops a judicially manageable standard for distinguishing excessive or unjustified delegations from those meeting, as Justice Taft had put it, the inherent necessities of governmental coordination. What is needed, in short, is a court that recognizes that the non-delegation principle, although it, like judicial review itself, is more structural than textual, is no less for that a part of the judiciary's charge to uphold the Constitution. Instead, the judiciary, shrinking before the authority of the legislature, has been complicit in allowing delegation run riot. If the judiciary failed to resist the encroachment of the Congress, then what can be said of the executive? In their recent book, The Unitary Executive, Professor Steve Calabresi, a founder of the society, and Professor Christopher Yu, remind us that every American president has asserted the right to direct the activities of the executive branch free of congressional interference. But that only makes one even more curious. How is it that although every president insists upon the unity and independence of the executive, that branch could be transformed into a junior varsity legislature, issuing innumerable regulations according to no intelligible principle dictated by the Congress, yet having by judicial interpretation the force of law? The fragmentation of the executive, despite both its unitary pedigree and the uninterrupted efforts of American presidents, can be a mystery only to those who focus on the formal lines of authority rather than political reality. Political scientists have long recognized that formally allocated powers are no guarantee of actual power. As Richard Neustadt trenchantly observed, the President of the United States has an extraordinary range of formal powers, but despite his powers, he does not obtain results by giving orders, or not at any rate merely by giving orders. Presidential power is the power to persuade, close quote. Presidents commonly have very little contact with agency heads, let alone lesser policymakers, and hence very little opportunity to persuade them. Instead, policymakers interact with and are open to persuasion by and become the clients of others, of congressional committees that oversee their work, of the industry they regulate, of the trade press that reports their every word, and of the permanent bureaucracy over which they nominally preside. The influence of these constituencies reinforces the natural tendency of an agency to pursue a maximalist agenda within its own narrow field of authority and without regard to competing values, let alone the objectives of the rather remote President of the United States. Considering the forces arrayed against the president within his own branch, I recur to Madison's insight that the weakness of the executive may require that it should be fortified. Perhaps the most vigorous and most effective proponent of an expansive administrative state, Franklin Roosevelt, was acutely aware of the need to shore up the executive against the Congress. His Committee on Administrative Management, commonly called the Brownlow Committee, recommended, with the president's enthusiastic support, the integration of the so-called independent agencies into the executive departments. The committee observed, the Constitution places in the president and in the president alone the whole executive power. Yet governmental powers of great importance are being exercised under conditions of virtual irresponsibility, close quote, by regulatory commissions beyond the president's direction. The Brownlow Committee's report seems as fresh today with financial regulation and health policy on the front page as it did in 1937. Listen. The commissions produce confusion, conflict, and incoherence in the formulation and in the execution of the president's policies. The president is held responsible for the wise and efficient management of the executive branch of the government. The people look to him for leadership. And yet we whittle away the effective control essential to that leadership by parceling out to a dozen or more irresponsible agencies, important powers of policy and administration. So the committee concluded that the independent agencies that should become a fourth branch of the government had no sanction in the Constitution and had begun to, quote, defeat the constitutional intent that there be a single responsible chief executive to coordinate and manage the departments and activities in accordance with the laws enacted by Congress. The committee, interestingly, invoked, although implicitly, the Lockean non-delegation principle that stood behind the constitutional design. Power, they said, without responsibility has no place in a government based on the theory of democratic control. For responsibility is the people's only weapon, their only insurance against abuse of power. In other words, the people having delegated legislative power to the Congress, that power could not properly be delegated further to an unelected and potentially unaccountable agency. Delegata potestas, non potest delegari. The Brownlow Committee's recommendations represented the executive's attempt to maintain the constitutional separation of powers through a robust non-delegation doctrine on the one hand and a unitary executive branch on the other. President Roosevelt said in transmitting the report to Congress, "What I am placing before you is the request not for more power, but for tools of management and the authority to distribute the work so that the president can effectively discharge those powers which the Constitution now places upon him. Unless we are prepared to abandon this important part of the Constitution, we must equip the president with authority commensurate with his responsibilities under the Constitution." To be more precise, but perhaps a little less diplomatic, President Roosevelt was asking for authority commensurate with his responsibilities, not for that, but for a rollback of the Congress's encroachment on his responsibilities. The Congress, of course, did not agree to decolonize the executive. Now, in this respect, the New Deal really does represent what Cass Sunstein's called an unfinished revolution, though not in the way, perhaps, that he had in mind. Roosevelt wanted the authority of the executive dispersed among specialized agencies subordinate to him, to the president, so the president would be presented with conflicting policy advice, disagreements, and options. That's precisely the circumstance in which the president can most effectively exercise his power to persuade as the ultimate decision maker by mediating intra-branch disputes and by shaping final agreements. Richard K. Betts at the Naval War College wrote of Roosevelt that he used bureaucratic competition and conflict to force issues to the top, maximizing the president's range of choice, close quote. That kind of policy leadership is impossible when important questions are resolved without ever reaching the White House or leaving the Environmental Protection Agency, for that matter. Because Roosevelt's revolution was incomplete in this respect, policy development and ultimate decision authority remained fragmented. All that advice, all those disagreements and options get filtered out in the departments and agencies. The decision is reached without the president ever having considered or even heard about the issue, let alone having balanced conflicting priorities in keeping with his vision of national policy. Madison was right, of course, about the imperial nature of the legislature. In Federalist 48, he wrote, "The legislature is everywhere extending the sphere of its activity and drawing all power into its impetuous vortex." Indeed, our system increasingly resembles the historical British system of parliamentary supremacy, and the framers most definitely did not adopt that. There, the executive and the judiciary exercise distinct powers, but only as agents of the legislature. Why, we might ask, did the framers disfavor that system? What did they understand that we have lost? First, they understood, and we have lost, accountability. Take an example that's not too recent, not so recent as to be controversial, the Clean Air Act, which the Congress in 1970 adopted or amended to force technological development by requiring automobile manufacturers to effect a 90% reduction in pollution emissions within 5 years, with devastating penalties for noncompliance, and absolutely no idea whether it could be done. But not wanting to be blamed either for failing to reach that goal or for destroying the industry, they delegated to the EPA authority to extend the deadline if necessary. And the EPA denied their request when the time came, and the companies came where? To the DC Circuit. And it fell to Judge Harold Leventhal, a distinguished jurisprude, but I know from personal experience, not much of an auto mechanic, to evaluate data from 500 test vehicles comparing a variety of approaches to catalytic conversion, none of which I understand, and none of which you would understand if I were to read them to you. It was the Court of Appeals, not the people's representatives, not even the bureaucrats at the EPA, who balanced the environmental costs of pollution against the economic cost to the auto industry. It was the Court of Appeals that decided whether to extend the deadline. To be sure, the court did so with an admission of doubts and diffidence, but nonetheless, it did so. Thus did the quasi-parliamentary system that has evolved result in a government of buck passing. The president lacks control over the policies of his nominal subordinates, all too often, when they're acting as the agents of the Congress. The Congress can claim to have delivered clean air or whatever, but disclaim the costs of achieving that goal, or if the goal is not achieved, disclaim responsibility for failure. The hard decisions are left to the agencies and ultimately to the courts, which have neither the legitimate authority nor the resources to evaluate complex policy matters or to balance costs and benefits to American society. Moreover, judicial decisions taken in this manner are made with neither energy and dispatch nor public deliberation, but as Judge Leventhal said, with doubts and diffidence. So the Supreme Court, understandably, is uncomfortable with the judiciary playing this role and has adopted a strategy of extreme deference to the legal conclusions of the agencies. In Chevron, the court upbraided the petitioners for, quote, waging in a judicial forum a specific policy battle which they ultimately lost in the agency, but one which was never waged in the Congress, close quote. The cost of taking the courts out of such policy battles was greater delegation to the agencies. And the Endangered Species Act makes it unlawful to take an animal on the list of endangered or threatened species. And the D.C. Circuit held that the EPA permissibly interpreted the word take to prohibit significant habitat modification. Because, I'm sorry, the Supreme Court did, reversing the D.C. Circuit. There's a take means also to engage in significant habitat modification, because to take includes to harm, and the animal could be harmed by the alteration of its habitat. Therefore, the Congress meant to delegate to the agency, and the agency permissibly held that altering the habitat is taking the animal. Okay. Second, the framers understood, and we have forgotten, that democracy is weakened when the locus of policymaking shifts from the legislature or the Congress to an agency. Theodore Lowy, political scientist, has argued, the delegation of policy problems to administrative agencies fosters the atrophy of the institutions of popular control. Because agency heads exercise their discretion in accordance with relationships between agencies and interest groups, rather than the full range of national priorities. Indeed, the point of the non-delegation doctrine was to keep the locus of lawmaking power in the Congress, where the requirements of bicameralism and presentment assure connection to the public will. If the Congress had to vote on the Code of Federal Regulations rule by rule, much if not most of it would surely fail. Yet those rules have the force of law without the Congress having voted at all. Instead, a phalanx of administrative officers in the executive working most closely with their congressional oversight committees and the industries they regulate write the rules that govern the various spheres of American life, indeed, almost all of them now. Third and last, the framers understood, and we have lost the energy that is the distinguishing characteristic of a unitary, independent executive. Hamilton, Federalist 70. That unity is conducive to energy will not be disputed. Decision, activity, secrecy, and dispatch will generally characterize the proceedings of one man in a much more eminent degree than the proceedings of any greater number. And in proportion as the number is increased, those qualities will be diminished. And indeed, they have been. Jurisdiction over the use and handling of formaldehyde, to take one little example, something that we encounter in our everyday lives, is shared among, you don't realize it. It's shared among the EPA, the OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the Food and Drug Administration, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and the Housing and Urban Development Department, each of which in its regulations applies different assumptions concerning key variables such as the value of a statistical life and the potency of a given concentration. And these are not the so-called independent agencies. These are all squarely within the executive branch. Yet each carries out a mandate from the Congress directly to the agency, and those congressional delegations displace the leadership of the executive. The lack of presidential control over the independent agencies is explicit. And so it is that the Secretary of Treasury today can promise swift action to restore confidence in the banking system, but cannot secure the cooperation of the independent FDIC, CFTC, or Securities and Exchange Commission. With the courts on the sidelines, what force is left to resist erosion of the accountability, democracy, and energy that the framers intended? The president may not always resist delegations of authority to executive agencies, certainly not always with success. But at least when the Congress attempts to dictate policies to the executive and to those agencies, every American president, without exception, has advanced the constitutional principle that the executive is unitary, long before Dick Cheney. Most recently, President Obama's administration has pursued two principal strategies to strengthen his control over the executive. First, he's tried to insulate policymaking in the executive branch from legislative control. In his first year, he has appointed about twice as many czars as the Romanov dynasty had in 300 years. They helped to formulate the president's policies on everything from economic recovery to peace in the Middle East. And they operate outside the morass of congressional oversight and agency rulemaking. Second, like his predecessors, President Obama has taken to issuing signing statements. Some of you may recall that he said he wouldn't do that, but that was a lapse of the tongue. So the signing statements have said, for example, that he is not bound to press for congressionally prescribed policies within international organizations, or to follow statutory format requirements for budget requests, or to accept congressional limitations upon the appointments of a commission, or to condition American participation in UN peacekeeping missions upon the approval of US military leaders, or to honor whistleblower protections for federal employees who give information to the Congress. Predictably, the czars and the signing statements have raised hackles in the Congress, which understandably prefers to have its own way in matters of policy. But so does the president, any president, every president. That, in the end, is the last, and for that reason alone, the best hope for our system of separated powers. As Madison put it, the great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachments of the others, close quote. With the constitutional means now lost, that great security has come down to personal motive, that is, to the fortitude of the president. Thank you.